Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus, or however you want to pronounce it. It's one of those names that you think you know how to pronounce. You've always pronounced it a certain name until suddenly you're sitting in the congregation and someone pronounces it completely differently. And you think, I really should have checked that out. So Ahasuerus is the way I've always said it. And no doubt Jason has always said it differently. And you probably have an alternative pronunciation. We're speaking about the same person, though, who, if you've got a marginal reference, it may say that he is generally identified with Xerxes the First, who reigned from 485 to 464 BC. Xerxes, despite its X's, is a much easier name to pronounce. When was he reigning? What are the events that were taking place at the time? Well, go back a little bit and go back to the year 586 BC. Another king was ruling the superpower of the day. That was King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. He's the king that overran Jerusalem and took the Jews into captivity. The time of the prophet Daniel, for example. But time has passed. The decades have rolled by, and so too has the balance of power shifted from Babylon to Persia. The opening words of the book of Ezra speak about Cyrus, king of Persia. He overran Babylon in 539 BC, and that marked a great turning point in the history of the Jews. Having been taken into captivity in Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, now Cyrus, king of Persia, frees them and allows those who want to travel back to Jerusalem. And over the following years, three groups of people migrated from Babylon to Jerusalem. The first in 538 BC under Zerubbabel. And they began the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. Then a second group went in 458 BC under the leadership of Ezra, after which man the book of Ezra in the Old Testament is named. And then a third group accompanied Nehemiah in 444 BC, and they were responsible for rebuilding the walls of the city of Jerusalem. Each of those groups moved under a different king on the Persian throne, it would seem. And the events that are recorded for us in the book of Esther are during the reign of this Xerxes, or Ahasuerus. He reigned somewhere around 485 to about 464 BC. Dates are somewhat uncertain, but around those dates. And we're told in the book of Esther that in the third year of his reign, round about 483 or 482 BC, he had this great feast that Jason read about for us from Esther chapter 1. So the events of the book of Esther take place under the reign of this king, Ahasuerus, who reigned between the first and the second groups that returned to Jerusalem. The group under Zerubbabel and the group under Ezra. And in this book of Esther we see that God's hand is at work in the history of the people of Israel. Those of you who are familiar with this book, let me just point out to you at this point, we'll come to it again later on in the series, but imagine if Mordecai hadn't heard of Haman's plot against the Jews. Imagine if the Jews in Persia had been eradicated, as had been Haman's desire. Ezra would never have gone. Nehemiah would never have gone to Jerusalem. The whole history of the Jewish nation would have been very different from what it is. And this book of Esther, the only book really that gives us a picture of the life of the Jews who remained in Persia, tells us of incidents, of events that were of not just incidental interest, but were of great importance to the future of the nation of Judah, and of course therefore to the kingdom of Christ into this world. So while the name of God is never once mentioned in the pages of this book, nevertheless it is His sovereign providence that is the theme of these pages. As we read this first chapter, as Jason read it to us, there may have been some things that stood out for you from this chapter. There were three things about this Persian king Ahasuerus that stood out for me as I worked through this chapter. The first one was the incredible power of this man. The opening verses tell us, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, that in the third year of his reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants. This man was a man of incredible power. He had inherited from Cyrus, his great-grandfather, I believe it was, from his grandfather and father, he had inherited this great empire of Persia, which stretched from India to Ethiopia, a vast number of provinces. And he had the supreme authority in this dominion that he had. He reigned supreme. He sat on the throne. The throne was the symbol of ultimate power. And here was this man. He was there on the throne in Shushan the citadel. He had great power that was indicated by the things that he was able to do. In the third year of his reign, he had a great feast. It's interesting that this coincides with a time when this king was setting out to push the boundaries of his kingdom and to prevent the rising Greek Empire from overrunning it. And in fact, this king's reign is marked by failure in that respect. The Greeks did overcome Persia in a number of areas during King Ahasuerus' reign. But this feast involves different people. It's for his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces. This is not just a feast to have a good party, but this is politics at work. He's winning friends. He's making allies. He's ensuring that he has the commanders of his armies that are spread out through all this vast empire on his side. And so he showed them the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. The mind boggles, doesn't it? This feast going on for 180 days. Well, we mustn't think that all the people were there for all the 180 days. No doubt what was going on was he was bringing people from different provinces over to Shushan and feasting them for a time. And then others would come in. So we shouldn't imagine that all the leaders of all the provinces were all together for all 180 days. Nevertheless, this was an amazing thing. I mean, you just imagine if a modern superpower, say the United States of America, was to court all its potential allies to the degree that Ahasuerus was doing here. It's phenomenal. And he had the power to do it. He had the ability to do it. He had the riches to do this. And when these days were complete, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel. Sort of a thank you gift for all the work that they had done, no doubt, over those 180 days. From great to small were invited to come in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with 4 to 5 linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. And the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Here is phenomenal generosity that is being shown. Obviously, there's a motive behind all of this, but look at what this king and his queen are able to do. What wealth they have, and what authority the king possesses. He can tell who should come, and he can draw them in his vast empire. He has the authority to do that. He has the authority down to even telling them how they should drink. Apparently it was the usual custom that whenever the king drank, everyone else had to drink. And the king is saying here, that's not the case. You can drink as little or as much as you want to, according to your own taste. But he has the authority to say, to dictate even that. And in fact, we hear of the law of the Medes and the Persians. They were renowned for their laws. So much so that the king didn't know what the law had to say when he needed some advice. And he called for his wise men and he asked them, well, what does the law say in this situation? Which we'll come to in a minute. What power, what wealth was displayed by this king in Persia. And here, in this kingdom of such great power and wealth, many of the Jews are living. In fact, the vast majority of the Jews remain in Persia rather than returning to Jerusalem. Under Cyrus, they were shown great privileges and freedoms that they hadn't known before, and their captivity of 70 years had now meant that the place had become home. Unlike Daniel and his friends who stood out in the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar and of Darius as being a man who, while honouring the king and serving him diligently, nevertheless kept their Jewish distinctiveness, refused to eat certain foods, refused to bow down and worship the king as God, and so on and so forth. It seems that the majority of the Jews were more or less integrated into society and had learned to enjoy the kindness that Persia could offer, and were unwilling to go with Zerubbabel and later with Ezra and Nehemiah back to Jerusalem to a life of hardship. Here they were in a land of incredible wealth, serving under a king of incredible power. But as you continue reading in this passage, you're also struck by incredible pride of this man. I mean, it's demonstrated there, isn't it, in the wealth. You know, he's parading himself, isn't he, and all that he possesses. Incidentally, not stuff that he's won, just stuff that he's inherited. He's full of his own self-importance, and he wants everyone to be aware of his immense riches and his immense power. He's a proud king in Persia. But it comes out even more as the story unfolds. On the seventh day of this great feast, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbana, Bigtha, Habagtha, Zippa, and Carter, seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring King Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials. For she was beautiful to behold. He's immensely proud of his wife and of the beauty of his wife. And so he brings her out along with her with the golden goblets to show off, just like another piece of furniture. Incredible pride of this man who has no thought for what his queen might be thinking, and for the work that she's doing in courting the good favour of the wives of the nobles, of the women in the royal palace. He wants her, he wants to show her off, to parade her. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. What happens? The king is furious, and his anger burns within. Alcohol has had its effect on the judgment of this king. He's become merry with wine. He's become intoxicated. And good judgment has given way to poor sense. And he makes these demands, and he does them in such a public parading way. He picks out seven eunuchs. He sends them in this public demonstration of his power and authority. And he gets a slap across the face, very public. No wonder his pride's hurt. And with the influence of alcohol, no wonder it turns to rage within him. Why did Vashti behave as she did? We often, as we read this passage, think what a proud and selfish woman she was. Husband's called her to show off her beauty. What's wrong with that, we think? What a stubborn woman not to do this. But think about it. Pause for a moment. Didn't Queen Vashti have any inkling whatsoever about the kind of power her husband had? Those of you who are familiar with the story will know that just a few verses later on we come to the fact that Esther is afraid to go before the king without being called because it could mean death for her. Are we to assume that Queen Vashti is ignorant of this status of a queen to the king of Persia? That her life can be cut off at a moment? Is she not aware that her refusal to such a public demand for her to come and show off her beauty would provoke the king to wrath? Is she ignorant of these things? Well, she's either very stupid or she has intoxicated king in the company of a crowd of intoxicated men who just want to hoo-hoo at her. And it was something that wasn't done. In Persia at this time, modesty was considered of a great value, and the idea of a king of all people parading his wife before a group of men as if in some kind of beauty contest, would have been very demeaning. She had her responsibilities. She was in the middle of hosting a party of her own. She had reason, whether we think it's good or not. She obviously thought it was good enough to risk her life in refusing this demand of the king. And consider the king for a moment. Had he not been influenced by alcohol, would he have requested her, demanded her to come this way? Even if he did want her to come, would he perhaps not more likely have accepted this? Do you have to introduce you to my friends? And even if he had sent an invitation, or even a demand, and that demand had been refused, if he was under the influence of alcohol, would he really have responded with such fury and anger? It's hard to believe. And it brings us to the third thing that really stands out in this passage. And it's the incredible paranoia of this king and of his cohorts. The king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being Karsin, Shethar, Adna, Tarshish, Meres, Messina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. The king of Persia, being such a great man of power, was also a great target for his enemies. And it was only those who were closest to him who had any kind of regular access into his presence. These were the most trusted men that he knew of. And he calls them to, what should we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs? This is the question the king wants to know. All these laws, what is there in all the vast host of laws of the Medes and the Persians that we can use in this instance? How can I get back at this queen who has so humiliated me before these people? And one of them, it seems without any discussion, stands up and says, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honour their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princess, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house, and speak in the language of his own. The king has been humbled, humiliated, by his wife's refusal to come and parade herself before his friends and allies, before the people he's trying to impress with his great riches, with his power and with his great authority. Suddenly, his authority is brought into question. What shall we do to Queen Vashti? So remember her being a great politician. Shifts the focus entirely away from any blame that the accusers of the king. After all, he retained his position. No suggestion at all that if only the king behaved a little more appropriately, he wouldn't be in his hot water. And that maybe an apology from the king might be in order. Banish the queen, yes, but acknowledge that it's not all one person's fault. No, this is a politician. He's not interested in the reality of the situation. He's saving his hide. He's working for the king's honour. That's his job. So all the blame falls on Queen Vashti. The king has been hurt. He's in danger. But then, so are all the princes. And in fact, every man throughout the provinces of this great empire is in danger of having wives who will no longer submit to their authority. This is a great tragedy in the kingdom of Persia. Look what Queen Vashti has done. She's a great advocate for every Persian feminist. And we must squelch this immediately and decisively. And so there's this incredible knee-jerk reaction to what's gone on in the palace in Shushan the citadel. And they don't think about all the consequences. They don't think about what they're saying about the other men and women throughout this great empire. And they write in law, which cannot be changed, certain things, including statements like, every man should be a master in his own house and speak the language of his own people. Every man must be a master in his own house. Well, king, why aren't you a master in your house? They're stating what was already the practice in most homes, except, obviously, the palace of the king. But it's all done to save face on the part of the king. And there's this great paranoia here. What would happen if every other woman did the same as Queen Vashti? But that assumes that every other woman has the character of Queen Vashti. What an insult to every other woman in the kingdom. What an insult to every other man in the kingdom. That they couldn't keep their own house in order. You see, the implications of this knee-jerk reaction to what's gone on in the palace there, showing great excess and poor judgment. See what's happened. We start off. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, as he sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel. In the third year of his reign, he made this great feast. And so the description goes on. And you get this picture of a man of incredible power, of immense wealth and authority. And by the end of the chapter, you get a completely different picture of a man who's lost all dignity and all propriety. He's an intoxicated tyrant. And he can't choose between good and evil, between what's appropriate and inappropriate. He's unable to make wise judgments and wise decisions. More than being intoxicated by wine, this man is intoxicated by his own grandeur. What a king to serve under. What a nation to live in. Incredible power, incredible authority, and incredible godlessness. Here's a king. He's head of the superpower of the world of his day. And he wants submission. And he wants to gather together a people who will support him and honour him and serve him. But he's a king who himself knows little about submission and giving honour to others and serving them as they are due. And you contrast this king with a greater king. This man, Xerxes, Ahasuerus, in that palace in Shushan, according to the archaeologist, had engraved in the pillars of that palace statements about himself. Should really have written them down and read them out to you. They were incredible statements, full of proud descriptions of his grandeur. And he virtually, though he didn't use these words, it was essentially these the same sense, called himself the King of Kings. But there is one who is truly King of Kings, whose power and majesty far surpasses that of King Ahasuerus. He may have reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, but there is one who reigns over all the world. And the hearts of King Ahasuerus is in his hand. And he dictates the course of events. Ahasuerus was a man full of pride in his, well, not even in his own achievements, but just in who he was and where he was. And there's a greater king who has all the more right to be proud of his achievements and of who he is and where he is, as he sits on the throne of the universe. And yet he doesn't show his pride in this way. In fact, while he is referred to as a jealous God, jealous for his own honour, and that men would respect him and serve him, and while he will bring into judgment all whose knees do not bow to him, nevertheless, this is a God who and King who shows incredible compassion to a world that has turned their back on him, to a people who are ignorant of his greatness, and when told of it, are unwilling to submit to his power and authority. And yet he shows mercy. He is patient. He doesn't become furious. His anger doesn't burn within him. But he is patient, as man does not understand patience, and longs that everyone who has not bowed him, and everyone who has turned their back on him, turn around, will repent, will acknowledge him as Lord and God of creation. He is a man described to us in Esther chapter 1 who is a paranoid, wondering where's the next attack going to come from? Where's the next person going to come who will undermine my authority and seek to snatch my kingdom from me? But there reigns on the throne of eternity a king who is sovereign in power and has absolute confidence in himself. There is no paranoia. He is constantly under attack from the world. His authority is constantly being undermined and questioned. But he never worries whether his throne will be taken from him. He's never concerned whether his kingdom is going to be snatched away. No one thwarts him in his purposes. All his plans are brought to perfect fruition. Jesus Christ reigns. The promised Son of David, whose kingdom and throne would be forever. That throne was never in danger of being taken away. And as we work through this book of Esther and we see the attempts to stamp out the memory of the Jews, we will see this God at work, preserving his kingdom and his future and the Saviour for the world that is fighting against him. Persia, what a world to live in. Full of riches and glorious buildings and majesty and pomp. Self-obsessed though. Full of its own grandeur, without a thought to others. A life lived for today, as presented to us in the life of the king. It's not so very different from today, is it? And the words then of John are pertinent to us today as they would have been had they been written in the time of Ahasuerus. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all this is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world, like Persia, is passing away. And the lust of it, all its grandeur and riches. But he who does the will of God abides forever. We can have confidence in this God who has true power and majesty and sovereignty. And he is using it not for his own benefit, not for his own honour and glory alone, but for his people. He works for his people. To save a people that had rebelled against him, that he wanted to bring back to himself. And he who does the will of God, he who comes back to God, turns away from the lusts of this world and sees his riches in God and in glory rather than here in this fleeting life. He will be saved and he will be eternally rewarded. What sort of king do you want to serve? A paranoid, powerful king full of pride? Or a sovereign, holy king of great power and majesty and great love and mercy?